Welcome to the February 2016 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. This issue is on the topic of endoscopic spine surgery. In this podcast, we hear a conversation between topic editor Dr. Ziago Kaslan and Dr. Albert Telfayen, both of Brown University. They discuss Dr. Telfayen and colleagues' article, A Brief History of Endoscopic Spine Surgery.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ziago Kaslan. I am the chair of neurosurgery at the Department of Neurosurgery of Brown University and Rhode Island Hospital. I have Dr. Albert Telfayen here, who is one of our faculty, and I have the pleasure of working with him and observing how endoscopic surgery is being applied to the whole spectrum of spinal disorders. So I'll ask Dr. Telfayen briefly to introduce himself. And then I have a series of questions for him related to specifics of the endoscopic spine surgery. Dr. Telfayen?
Thank you very much, Dr. Kaslan. So this is Albert Telfayen, and I am an associate professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
Albert, just to start, I just wanted to know how long have you been involved with endoscopic spine surgery and how actually you have learned some of the initial techniques related to that?
So I have been performing endoscopic spine surgery since 2005. And it was then that I had done probably 3,000 or 4,000 spine surgeries. It was earlier in my career. But I had my first herniated disc in my own back. And I was really, I was very much suffering with it, and it wasn't getting better. And that was when I first started investigating the possibility of endoscopic spine surgery. And how I learned to do it was really a journey. And I would, anytime I would hear of someone in the world who had experience doing it, I would take a week off of work. I flew to the former East Germany, a couple hours outside of Amsterdam. I would go to these places, and I would stay for days until someone was doing a case. And over this journey, I've made many friends from around the world, and that we've helped each other really explore and perfect some endoscopic spine surgery techniques. So it's really, you know, a story that's very similar to any of the emerging techniques in neurosurgery. There's a lot of sharing that goes on and mentoring, and you have to do more than just go to a CME course. You really have to go somewhere in the world and learn from someone. So it's been an incredibly interesting and satisfying part of my career.
Well, I'm delighted to hear this. And for a practicing neurosurgeon or for somebody who does spine surgery as a large part of his or her practice on a regular basis, how would you explain to that person in terms of what distinguishes endoscopic spine surgery from non-endoscopic spine surgery? As you know, we have many ways of addressing some of these pathologies using microscopes or tubular retractors, using some of the minimally invasive techniques. How is endoscopic spine surgery different?
I think that's a great question. And the way we perform non-endoscopic spine surgery, we are just either using the naked eye, loops, microscope, and the way I will make the analogy for people is that years ago, if we went to war, we sent troops. Or if you wanted to do space travel, you sent astronauts in a rocket. You know, today we have beautiful pictures of Mars because we send a rover. You know, or we are involved in military activities by sending drones. It's where we're putting the eye. So with non-endoscopic spine surgery, the light is traveling, like with a microscope, 30 to 50 centimeters. Here, we're putting the camera's eye right at the point of the pathology, then transmitting it electronically. And so the advantage that gives you is, one, you have amazing visualization because the actual pathway of light is a very short distance. And two, you can do these surgeries with extremely small incisions and small instruments because you don't need to open up to let the light travel. And so that for me is the best way to explain it. It also kind of involves the answer of why is this happening now? Because this is happening in multiple fields.
How did the field of endoscopic spine surgery arise? And why is it that it's not known by most people and most people haven't heard about it?
Well, so it didn't arise overnight. In the 70s, surgeons were performing percutaneous nucleotomies. They were sticking Craig cannulas in the disc to try to do a nuclear decompression. And then in the 80s, that needle then became a rigid rod lens scope that was going into the disc. And the results, you know, were very difficult to determine whether people were actually getting better. Some people got better. You were doing a nucleus decompression. And then the 90s, people, the scope started to get better. The surgeons started to work on foraminal surgery. They were starting to remove the ventral portion of the superior articulating process of the facet. They were using drills and reamers. And so the scope moved out of the disc into the foramen, and you were able to see foraminal pathology. Then at the same time, high definition started to come later. And so I call that the small to big evolution. And then at the same time, the different evolution was coming in open surgery. We had bigger incisions, and then we had microdiscectomy, and then we had Foley's great article in 1999 using tubular retractors for far lateral discs, and he stuck an endoscope down the tube. So we had this convergence from small to big and from big to small. And so there they were meeting in the late 90s, early 2000s, where you could do this surgery, and it all was converging in the endoscope. And because once you get your incision so small, you need a way to visualize. And so it's been a very interesting evolution. And the answer for why it isn't better known, I would have to say, is that these surgeries are difficult to learn. There's a long, slow learning curve. And none of us learned these things in fellowship or residency, and the evolution didn't come from one person. It evolved in multiple areas in the world where people began doing it because it made sense. So even today, I mean, we're talking about this on a podcast. We have a special issue of the Neurosurgery Focus for February on endoscopic spine surgery, but still many people in our field have never heard of it.
That's very interesting. I think you touched upon this earlier with respect to your own experience, but how did you become interested in endoscopic spine surgery? Having articulated all these initial sort of difficulties and the lack of training and so forth.
I think it was really due to my initial first 5 years in practice. I was treating so many patients, and when I had patients with discogenic back pain, I was doing the lumbar artificial disc, and I was getting good results. And the patients with discogenic back pain, foraminal stenosis, you know, the spine disease is such a prevalent disease, and geriatric patients, everyone as they get older suffers from, it seems, some sort of spine pathology. And it just seemed so obvious that you could help so many people if you could offer something that was super minimally invasive. I published an article several years ago on patients that were 75 and older, and they all had endoscopic spine surgery, awake, outpatient, and they had an 80% rate of excellent or good after their surgery. So it really just became motivation as a physician and a surgeon. It's like, wow, you know, you have so many patients that would seem to be benefiting from something if you could do it super minimally invasive. It was really just something that you feel you could do for your patients. And so that really was the motivation.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. And to follow up on that, what spine pathologies can be best considered for surgical treatment endoscopy?
So this is the whole area of my current research, is to try to apply endoscopic techniques to all spine pathologies. As you know, I published an article last year that was the first awake endoscopic spine surgery for an intracanal spinal tumor. I have an article in the Focus about the cadaveric basis for the idea of endoscopic fusions, the idea of turning a transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion to a completely endoscopic procedure, possibly done on an awake patient, possibly not needing instrumentation. So I think the possibility is, if we step back and say endoscopic spine surgery is not different from spine surgery, it's just using this new tool in the toolbox. And if you look at it that way, then you can apply endoscopic techniques to any pathology in spine surgery. And so it's just like saying, oh, I'm doing an open surgery. Maybe I would be able to do something with a microscope during this case because, you know, the pathology is so small. I think that's the same thing with the endoscope, that it's not going to take over spine surgery. It's going to just be part of our routine in spine surgery. It's just another tool in the toolbox for the spine surgeon.
Well, I think you briefly brought up in your answer to the question before, do you think that the standard fusions can be performed endoscopically?
So that is an area that I am working on. I obsess over who would be the patient that would benefit from an endoscopic spine surgery that would diffusion. Well, somebody that in my practice has a herniated disc, well, then they come in and re-herniate again. Well, then I'm going to do a second discectomy. Well, then the third time they re-herniate in my practice, well, they need a fusion. Well, what if I could go in there, remove the herniation endoscopically, clean out the rest of the disc space, put in a cage, expandable, 3D printed titanium, you know, some special cage that I could put down a small endoscopic channel. And then, you know, there's many options for percutaneous instrumentation. And you could do this with the patient awake. It could be an outpatient surgery. And what would the advantage of that be? Not needing general anesthesia, shorter hospital stays, possibly quicker rehab. And these are the same results we're seeing with the non-fusion endoscopic spine surgeries, where we're finding the same results and benefit, except that it's faster recovery time. And so it, again, is something that is new, and it's something that several of us are working on around the world, is trying to perfect the idea of endoscopic fusion, because those would be the advantages. The preliminary work shows that there are some difficulties. They're trying to navigate the narrow corridor of Cambin's triangle, that narrow space between the exiting and traversing nerve roots. That's a small space to try to navigate a cage, whether it's expandable or rigid. And then you always have to ask yourself, is what you're doing the best thing for the patient? Because if they really benefit from a more significant bony decompression, then you're not doing that so much with the endoscope. But, you know, and these are the same kind of issues we brought up when people were doing lateral fusions. And we saw, well, you know, patients could do quite well by having an indirect decompression. So I think it's, you know, we're going to have to look at it that same way, that there's the advantages of lateral fusion, but there's also disadvantages to those. So I don't think that endoscopic fusion will replace more open fusion techniques, but I think it'll be in our armamentarium of minimally invasive spine fusions.
It looks like it's a very exciting field indeed. And other question related to endoscopic spine surgery, what are the risks of the endoscopic spine procedures? How are they different than open procedures?
Well, the risks that are shared, the same where we have bleeding and infection, spinal fluid leak, you know, the risks that are the same with open surgery, but the additional risk that's a little bit different is that you're operating through often a 4 to 5 millimeter incision. And if there's a bleeding problem, well, then you have to consider, well, you know, are you going to need to convert to an open procedure for this? And so that's a little bit different from open surgery, that you're doing something that's essentially percutaneous, and you're operating, you know, maybe 20 centimeters away from where you're entering the skin. So that's definitely an additional risk. And nerve root injury, I do all of my endoscopic spine surgery with the patient awake. So I really have never had a significant nerve injury, but certainly there is an incidence of dysesthesia where you've irritated the dorsal root ganglion of the exiting nerve, usually above the pathology. And those of us who have done hundreds and hundreds of these around the world find that our incidence of that complication decreases with our experience, because that narrow corridor of Camden's triangle is very unforgiving. You have to be so accurate with your needle placement so that you're not leaning on the DRG. It's the same thing we found when, you know, we've done lateral disc surgeries in the open or through a tubular retractor. It's a very sensitive area, and patients will do well, and then several days or a week later start to complain of a dysesthetic pain down the leg in the distribution in the exiting nerve. So that's, again, another complication that's a little specific to the endoscopic procedure.
This is my final question, Albert. I think you briefly brought this up earlier as well, but I want to know how long it would take for somebody to get comfortable with endoscopic spine surgery. What is the learning curve for this procedure?
So there have been multiple publications on the long, shallow learning curve for endoscopic spine surgery, that it takes a while to get good with it. Now, based on the fact that so many of us that have been doing endoscopic spine surgery have taught ourselves, I think that learning curve will get shorter and shorter as this is brought into residency and fellowship programs. As you know, our residency at Brown, your spine fellowship at Brown, offers trainees open surgery, percutaneous surgery, endoscopic surgery, congenital spine surgery. So now we're just starting to see the first academic spine programs that are offering endoscopic training. So for these newer fellows and newer residents, this is going to be available for them. And so when they graduate, they're going to have full skills in doing endoscopic spine surgery. I think it's for the guys that are already out in practice, the guys that are already have established spine practices, that it's going to be more of a challenging route to learn these things, because you have to go to a cadaver course. And then, as you know, we have surgeons from around the world come visit us at Brown to observe endoscopic spine surgeries. And then some people will ask me to go proctor them for cases. Some people that have advanced minimally invasive backgrounds pick it up right away and are good at it immediately. So, but it's one of those skills that takes time to learn.
It looks like this is really an incredibly exciting field. I can attest to that firsthand from my own experience here at our institution, where I have seen how the patients who are medically fragile with specific pathologies can benefit from that. I applaud you for your efforts, and thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation on endoscopic spine surgery.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to participate in this interview, and thank you for all your help with the contributions to this month's Neurosurgery Focus. I think it's a very special issue, and the journal Neurosurgery has just been so generous to give us this forum for surgeons around the world to make their contributions on the field of endoscopic spine surgery available to our U.S. readers and our readers abroad. So thank you very much, Dr. Glucaslon.
It has been truly a pleasure. I learned an incredible amount. Again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks. Have a great day.
This concludes our podcast for the February issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the March issue, when the topic will be Utility of Intraoperative Imaging. Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. And for more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.